Coming to the end of the year is a great time to look back at some of our favorite conversations of 2019, including one about the impact of science on the Cold War.
Ideas about science really did help win the Cold War, but in fairly subtle ways.
We'll also spend some time reviewing the teacher labor actions from early in the year and spend an academic minute checking time on your body clock. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is the Best of Our Knowledge. The relationship between science and politics has always been complicated, but they've always been intertwined. That's the premise of Audra J. Wolfe's book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. Audra Wolfe is a writer, editor, and historian whose work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and on the podcast American History Tellers. When we spoke early in the year, I asked her why she took on this project.
Well, you know, I started researching this project as a biography of a geneticist named Bentley Glass. I had been interested in Glass for a long time because he seemed to go against everything that historians of science thought that they knew about the Cold War. This was a guy who was very politically active. He was somewhat involved in civil rights concerns, and he spoke out against government policies about fallout. But his career only seemed to flourish, and I was trying to understand how this guy could be so politically active and yet still have access to such high channels of power. And eventually I realized that his actions weren't nearly as oppositional as they seemed, particularly in the international arena, and that the State Department and the CIA found people like Bentley Glass useful, even while the FBI was investigating him for issues of possibly being too much on the left. So I began to understand that there was a much more complicated situation happening with scientists and their relationship to power during the Cold War, and I wanted to understand that.
Did science help win the Cold War, or was it just the battlefield?
Ideas about science really did help win the Cold War, but in fairly subtle ways. On the one hand, of course, science can be used as a kind of intelligence gathering. So scientific intelligence was certainly important to the Cold War. But the story that I tell in the book is much more about ideas about science, sort of science as a way of life, science as a kind of freedom that was the opposite of how science was being conducted in the Soviet Union. And the United States used these ideas about how science should operate and how scientists should be to try to build relationships with scientists throughout the rest of the world, especially in the global south. And these ideas were really compelling. And by the end of the Cold War, they were fairly common. There was a fairly global consensus that science should operate as an objective approach to gathering facts, and that science should be free from political concerns, and that science shouldn't know borders. All of that was language that came out of the United States position in the Cold War.
However, in the book, you say it was kind of naive to think that science isn't political.
Of course, it's naive, and in some ways it's an aspirational claim, but it's still a useful claim. So to say that science should be apolitical, to say that science operates better under freedom, that science operates best under freedom, that's not a naturally occurring thing. It's something that has to take place from a series of political choices. And during this time period, that was a compelling political choice. But if scientists want to have some degree of scientific freedom, they have to be willing to argue for it, and that itself is a political choice.
I want to just go back to the beginning. How did you get access to this information? I mean, a lot of this stuff was, at the time, classified.
Yeah, that's a really great question. A lot of information about the origins of the national security state in the Cold War has been declassified in the past 15 to 20 years, and I did some Freedom of Information requests on my own, so some of the material was declassified very recently. But at the same time, a lot of the stories told in this book are about covers that were blown in 1967. And the thing about a cover organization is that when it's effective, you can talk about it. So organizations that received money from functioning cover organizations could list them in their annual reports. So I found any number of documents in the archives of individual scientists that talked about receiving money from organizations that we now know were actually fronts, in some cases from the CIA, to do some kind of covert diplomacy. So it's an interesting story that you can tell if you know that you're working with a cover. And that's really the trick, is to know what you're looking at.
You talk about the CIA's role with a lot of student organizations in trying to get young people into this. Talk about that a bit.
Sure. Well, so the CIA in general was working with a lot of private organizations to carry out its cultural messages. In part, this was about plausible deniability, that the United States wanted to be able to hide the government's involvement in it, in part because they weren't sure what these individuals would do. But there was also an ideological component, that if the message that you're trying to convey is that the government doesn't control its citizens, it's hard to do that if you're acknowledging the government's support. So student groups, the National Student Association was one of the main groups that the CIA was working with in the 1960s. When their cover was blown in 1967, that really took the lid off of all of these cover relationships. The public suddenly learned about the CIA's relationships with labor organizations, with groups of intellectuals, with artists, and with scientists as well, which is part of the story that I'm telling here.
Did both sides of the Cold War work independently of each other, or was there some cooperation?
Well, American scientists and Soviet scientists did actually build some cooperative relationships during this time period. What's interesting and complicated about understanding these relationships is that both the United States and the Soviet Union were also using those relationships to facilitate intelligence gathering. Not necessarily cloak and dagger style intelligence gathering, but some basic facts about how science is operating in that other country. A lot of basic scientific intelligence gathering is that sort of information. Like, what are the key research centers? What are the research strengths? The United States in particular was encouraging relationships between American scientists and Soviet scientists, and really between American scientists and any number of international scientists, as a way to gather that sort of baseline scientific intelligence. At the same time, these relationships serve to show how the United States was encouraging its scientists to be open and free. So it was simultaneously heightening this contrast with the Soviet Union at the same time that it was also doing something really concretely useful.
If I were to walk up to 10 people on the street right now and talk about the role of science in the Cold War, I'm sure 9, maybe 10 of them would say, oh, you're talking about the space race, right? How much was the space race involved in this?
The space race is a really important example of technological achievement. But what that meant was that for a long time, the Soviet Union was winning that race. And particularly right after the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the United States really didn't think that it was going to catch up. And so the language that the United States used to talk about science in its international propaganda efforts really switched then, in part to draw a contrast between the Soviet emphasis on technology and an American emphasis on basic science. So the United States was drawing up literature, making films, doing radio broadcasts that were really meant to highlight that, yes, the United States may not be able to pull off that kind of technological spectacle that the Soviet Union could, but it could be more cooperative. It could be the best scientific partner. It could win Nobel Prizes. It's a complicated relationship in the late 1950s. And of course, eventually the United States pulled ahead in the space race. But even then, the United States wanted that narrative to be, we managed to do this in a democracy where it's even harder to do technological achievement than it is in the Soviet Union.
There is a lot of talk right now about getting students involved in the STEM activities. How much back then was getting students involved in science? Was it a priority then?
Absolutely. After Sputnik, when the United States was trying to understand what had happened, why the United States was losing the space race so badly, one of the things that they looked at was both undergraduate science education and high school science education. So there were any number of high school curriculum reform projects that were started during this time period in most fields, physics, biology, earth sciences, chemistry. And what's really interesting about these programs is that they all highlighted what they called the nature of inquiry. So the idea was not so much to teach facts, but to teach students to think in a certain way about science. And these books themselves then became part of these diplomatic efforts with both overt and covert agencies backing their translations around the world.
You talk a lot in the book about the concept of scientific freedom. Did either side of the Cold War actually have that?
It depends on what one means by scientific freedom. It's an irony of the Cold War that in the United States, you know, American scientists were receiving more funding from the federal government during this time and in some ways faced more security restrictions than probably at any other peacetime in U.S. history. So you definitely had to sort of follow certain rules to be able to have access to scientific freedom. But if you could meet those requirements, if you were a white male scientist who had a background without any hint of leftist affiliations, you could get nearly unlimited funding to research whatever you wanted. So this was not a fully open system, and it wasn't open to everyone. But for the people who did have access to it, it seemed extraordinarily free.
Some of those people who got the funding used science or manipulated science to promote some pretty repugnant views. I'm thinking of your story there about William Shockley.
Yes. So William Shockley, he received a Nobel Prize for his work in electronics. He was a pioneer in the science of transistors. But after he received his Nobel Prize, he became very, very interested in what he would think of as race science and questions of the relationship between race and IQ, really repugnant work. So he started using this language of scientific freedom in the late 1960s to try to urge the national academies to do studies about the relationship between race in science. And it's an interesting moment in this story because the scientists involved with the National Academies basically said, no, we're not going to research this. This is repugnant. You can find someone else to fund this and do this work if you want to do it. So Shockley accused them of basically being like the Soviet Union, of shutting down research lines. And in this open moment of the late 1960s and early 1970s, scientists with the National Academies were willing to say, you know what? Yes, there are some politics here, and we're not going to do this because this work is not helpful and it's not in the service of justice.
You talk also about the use in the Cold War of psychological warfare. I guess Eisenhower was really into that sort of thing. What is psychological warfare? How was it used in the Cold War?
Well, psychological warfare is a fairly broad term, and as national security specialists were using it from the late 1940s through the mid-1950s, it could really be almost anything short of live bullets from uniformed armies. So everything from economic warfare, we can think of the Marshall Plan as a version of psychological warfare, to dropping leaflets over foreign countries, to propaganda of the deed, things like sponsoring concerts that would show the American approaches to music. So there's a wide variety of activities here. Many of them are done covertly without government acknowledgement. But the point of all of them is to avoid a hot war. And the reason that was so important, of course, was because after 1949, both the United States and the Soviet Union had atomic weapons. And so a hot war was almost unimaginable and would probably destroy the entire world. So both the United States and the Soviet Union were really interested in ways that they could further this conflict while avoiding a hot nuclear war.
Well, the Cold War didn't last forever. What happened to science and the government's relationship after the Cold War ended in the late 80s, early 90s?
What's been an interesting postscript, I think for most of the 80s and 90s, when the United States was still using ideas about science and diplomacy, it was mostly as expertise. So the idea that you needed scientific information to answer questions, but not necessarily that you would use science as a way of life to build alliances. That changed under the Obama administration, which really pushed science as a way of life as a sort of olive branch to Muslim countries after the global war on terror. What we're seeing in the current administration is a sea change from these prior administrations, in that all of the prior administrations would at least give lip service to the idea that scientific expertise was important and that both domestic and foreign policy decisions needed access to scientific expertise. The current administration is not particularly interested in scientific expertise, and it's been applying litmus tests for certain scientific views, particularly for climate change. So that's a really dramatic difference, something that we haven't really seen since the end of World War II.
Again, the name of Audra J. Wolfe's book is Freedom's Laboratory: The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. Still to come, the labor actions by teachers in 2018 continued into early this year. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Early this year, teachers at the Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest district in the country, reached a new labor agreement with its teachers after a six-day walkout. This strike followed a number of job actions by teachers last year in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, and other states. I spoke about this trend with Dr. Robert Shand, an assistant professor in the School of Education at American University. I asked Dr. Shand about his interest in the teacher labor movement.
I was a teacher. I was a member of the United Federation of Teachers in New York City, so I do have something of a personal invested interest, but also I'm an education policy scholar who focuses on teachers as a subject of academic inquiry, but really thinking about that in real terms and in terms of an interest in what's happening in our schools and what's the effect on students, and making sure that we're able to attract and recruit and retain the best quality teachers possible. And I think part of that is some of the things that teachers are demanding in the strikes in terms of fair pay and working conditions. So I guess as a former teacher, as a researcher, as a citizen, and as someone who is concerned about our schools and our students and the sort of future of our country. So I would say I have a multifaceted interest.
There was one major labor action in Los Angeles. Was that different than your average teacher strike?
I mean, it was different in a couple of ways. I wouldn't say it's dramatically different. I mean, I think that there's a growing national movement. There are two major national teacher unions, the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association. And then I think certainly with the internet and the rise of social media, just as with almost any other political or policy issue, the debate has largely become nationalized. I think the LA strikes were a little bit different in a few respects, partly just in terms of magnitude. The Los Angeles Unified Schools are the second largest school district in the country. Obviously LA is a major city, a major media center, so that draws a lot of attention. I think a strike of that magnitude requires a certain amount of organization, and I think more so than any others, I think the LA strikes brought to the forefront that teachers weren't just advocating for themselves and for their own pay and benefits, but also for what they see as in the interest of the schools and the students. So teacher unions are a little bit different broadly than some other labor unions, because as a professional union on a matter of very clear public interest, I guess this might be similar to, for instance, police unions, they not just are sort of self-advocating, but they are expressing positions on public policy matters and kind of advocating for policies that affect their sector, for policies that affect the schools and the students. And I would say, for better or worse, there's some research that suggests that teachers are very effective advocates and they bring in more resources to schools, and they are very concerned about raising the prominence of public education and our investment in public education. There's some research by Carolyn Hoxby at Stanford, for instance, that also finds, though, that they divert resources not just to what's best for the students, but also in some cases what's best for the teachers. I think very often that goes hand in hand, but that certainly can come into conflict at times.
What I noticed from media coverage of the strike was it seemed to be, I mean, granted, there were disagreements, but it seemed to be almost civil. No one was screaming at each other. It seemed like a civil conversation between the sides, at least in the media.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think we see now the major strikes last year in West Virginia and Oklahoma and other places where maybe the other side of the bargaining table is more right-leaning politically, those strikes were arguably more contentious. And now there's also, just recently, there's been some talk of some potential backlash. There's legislation, to some extent, there are some legislators, and who knows where it will go. And I would guess a lot of this is sort of symbolic posturing on the part of legislators that none of this is really going to turn into too much. But there's some concern that there's some backlash against teachers in West Virginia in particular that may be seen as almost sort of an attempt by the legislature to punish them for striking. And I don't think we see that as much in Los Angeles. I would tend to agree that it seems like the district genuinely wanted to do whatever they could to meet the union's demands and was being as sincere as they could in saying that they simply couldn't afford to. And that both sides really, I think, ultimately what they want is for the state of California to be providing more funding for the district.
Well, you mentioned the West Virginia strike, and that's something I wanted to get to. Those strikes last year, starting with West Virginia and then going into other states, the wildcat kind of strikes, those were much less organized and did seem much more contentious.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there certainly still was a level of organization. I mean, that there was the wildcat component where the West Virginia teachers continued striking even after the union leadership felt they had reached a deal with the state leaders. Partly it's inherently less organized simply because Los Angeles is a single district, whereas West Virginia is an entire state, and most teachers' unions are organized where the basic bargaining unit is at the level of a local school district or a county, requiring coordination across an entire state. And then West Virginia itself is a predominantly rural and mountainous state. I think to some extent it's going to be inherently less organized, and it's pretty remarkable, actually, I think, the extent to which teachers self-organized, and I think social media online played a major role in that as well.
Looking ahead, are teachers becoming more emboldened or mobilized? Will we see more of these strikes, either organized or disorganized?
I think so. I mean, I think they've met with some success. I don't think teachers necessarily want to strike. I mean, I think they want to go to work and do the job that they're paid to do, and they're well aware of the disruptive effects that the strikes can have on students, on schooling. The strikes are costly to the district, to the students, and to them. So I don't know that we'll necessarily see a ton more strikes. I think maybe what we'll see is other more aggressive actions, more threats of strikes, with the hope that the threat doesn't need to be followed through, but that education leaders, administrators, those who are on the other side of the negotiating table, will see that these threats are credible, that teachers have successfully struck and received increases in pay and benefits and in funding to education in return. So I think some of the successes that we've seen in the teacher labor movement in the past year will embolden them. I think some of this is also a reaction to a number of changes in light of, we're still feeling some of the lingering effects of the Great Recession, and that education funding levels adjusted for inflation have in most places not even returned to the levels they were at pre-recession. I think there was a lot of wrongheaded policies at the federal, state, and local levels, the sense of, well, we need to share the pain, and if other people are unemployed and things like that, we need to be kind of cutting the government services as well to sort of signal that we're being austere and we're sharing the pain, which is, I think, from an economic perspective, the exact opposite of what we need to be doing in terms of stimulating the economy. But I think all of these effects still linger. And so, you know, I think it's not just the successes that we see in West Virginia and Los Angeles and other places that the movement has had, but I think it's a reaction to a number of factors, including perhaps some overstepping by education reformers, and there's some pendulum swinging in the opposite direction, continued underfunding or funding that is beneath pre-recession levels at the state and local level in many, many places, and then rising healthcare and pension costs, which continue to crowd out money for teacher salaries, for smaller classes, and for other investments. And so I think also you might see more of a push for healthcare reform and concerns on both sides of the table, the rising cost of healthcare.
I will say you can find no more different places in the world than Los Angeles and West Virginia. But were there common threads in the demands for these movements?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's the obvious ones. Everyone would advocate for more pay. I think that despite the tremendous differences, I think the challenges that public education is facing is remarkably similar in places. Teachers certainly get paid a lot more in Los Angeles than in West Virginia, but in both places, it's below the median wage for other college graduate professions. And so I think the feeling that teachers are sort of underpaid at teachers' pay and benefits has not kept pace with inflation. They're asked to contribute more and more to their health care, large classes. The idea that teachers are not just advocating for their own pay and benefits and working conditions, but advocating for the education system in general. I think there are these common threads. And then also, it might be surprising, but West Virginia has among the lowest teacher salaries in the nation. That piece is not terribly surprising, given the economy of West Virginia. But California is, despite being a really wealthy state and a fairly progressive state, is not a leading state in investing in public education. Since Proposition 13 and the strong historic opposition to taxation in California, the levels of state and local investment in public education are generally below the national average in California. So that might be a somewhat surprising similarity between the two places.
Dr. Robert Shand is an assistant professor in the School of Education at American University. Is your body clock keeping good time? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How important is it to be in tune with your circadian clock? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jennifer Hurley, assistant professor of biological sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, delves into this question.
Most life on Earth is tuned to the planet's 24-hour cycle by a system we call the circadian clock. This clock creates daily oscillations in many organisms, including humans, and controls a great deal of physiology, for example, the sleep-wake cycle. Interfering with the circadian clock is a serious affair. Research shows that people who regularly function out of sync with their circadian clocks, like night shift workers, exhibit increased rates of cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and many more ailments. Circadian clocks are built to receive and interpret information from the environment. However, until recently, scientists assumed that the clock was buffered against effects of most constant environmental conditions, reasoning that a clock should tick consistently regardless of its surroundings. However, our research challenges that assumption. Our work investigated the circadian clock of a plankton that had adapted to living in water contaminated by dissolved road salt. By tracking the plankton's clock at the molecular level, using levels of messenger RNA, we found that the circadian clock in these plankton had stopped ticking, even when the dissolved road salt was no longer present. Put plainly, this suggests that the adaptation to tolerate an environmental contaminant can permanently suppress circadian functions long after the contaminant is gone. The potential implications of this research are substantial. From an environmental perspective, plankton, which are a food source for many fish, may be making a monumental trade-off in their effort to tolerate environmental contaminants. As plankton participate in a daily migration that may be guided by their circadian clock, the disruption of plankton clocks could affect an entire aquatic ecosystem. From a human health perspective, the circadian clock in humans is similar to that in plankton. Therefore, our research suggests that it is possible that the human clock may also be affected as a result of exposure to environmental contamination, implying that environmental contaminants could have a broader human health effect than what is currently recognized.
That was Jennifer Hurley of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.